This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It has been a decade since newspaper photographer David Praber took an iconic photo of a serial bank robber in the median of an interstate.
He had with him what appeared to be a pistol of some sort, and he pointed it at the police cars that were chasing him.
GLT's Ryan Denham talks to Praber about that dangerous day and his surprising view of the robber's life. Plus, some high schools are not at all thrilled with the new centralized scheduling process for football games, Eric Stock reports, and a new study is out on how to implement the complete streets plan in Bloomington Normal. Ryan Denham interviews Jennifer Six of the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. 10 years ago, at the height of the Great Recession, Bloomington Normal police were hunting for a serial bank robber. On Monday, January 5th, 2009, they found their man, Robert Sylvester. He had just robbed a payday loan store. Police were in hot pursuit, and so was David Praber. Praber is the photo editor at the Pantograph. The images he would capture that day of Sylvester's final violent moments would become iconic. You've probably seen them, the old man with a gun and the cigarillo. GLT's Ryan Denham talks to Praber about that dangerous day and his surprising view of Sylvester's life.
They began to kind of start putting some information together that led them to have an idea about what this person looked like and maybe what he was driving. They were on the lookout for this person, and what happened next was that one afternoon, the person that they were looking for turns up robbing a small cash-and-go, check-and-go store here in...
So how do you, as a photographer, find out there's a police chase going on?
Well, I was sitting in the newsroom, and Julie Gerkey, our managing editor, who was at the time sitting right across from me, she had a scanner on her desk, and there was quite a bit of commotion, which tends to, if you're a photographer or a police reporter, tends to kind of perk your ears up a little bit. You start listening into the conversation, and Julie turned to me and said, "I think they've got this chase going on with this bank robber." It sounded to me like they were headed towards I-39. Kind of began to realize I've got enough noticed here to try and get into position at maybe a point where they might stop this individual and maybe get some photographs of the arrest. I got into my our newsroom car at the time. We had two newsroom cars at the Pantograph. Got on I-5574 and started heading north.
So how do you ultimately come almost face-to-face with Robert Sylvester?
That police chase was heading southbound on I-39. What was lucky was that the police who were in chase, primarily Lexington at that point, was calling out the mile markers as they were headed down south. And I knew where the mile markers were on I-55, 74, and 39. And I realized that they were headed towards south, towards Bloomington, towards possibly Market Street. And I thought maybe I'll give it a chance to find out whether or not I can intercept them at some point north of there. As I began getting close to where the chase was proceeding south, I noticed that they were talking about deploying some devices that would blow up the suspect vehicle's car tires. And I sort of made a guess as to where that stop actually might occur, which was on I-5574, about where Normal Community West High School was. And I pulled over and into the emergency lane in the hope that at least I would get the chase, pictures of the chase headed south. Surprisingly to me, the chase ended right where I was parked. Sylvester's car tires at that point were blown out, and he lost control of his vehicle. He was headed in the southbound lane. And I noticed that he hit the embankment. There's this concrete embankment between the northbound and southbound lanes. And his car ended up basically facing where I was at within probably 50 feet. That's sort of what happened.
So you're parked in the emergency lane on the northbound side. Okay.
Yeah.
you see him getting out of the car, and he's carrying what looks like a gun. It turns out to be a fake gun.
What happened was is that he got out of the car. His actually was an SUV, and there were two or three squad cars at that point that were relatively close behind him. They, of course, did an emergency braking maneuver and they didn't exactly surround his car, but they were behind it and off to the side. He got out, had with him what appeared to be a pistol of some sort, possibly an automatic. I wasn't sure at that point. And he pointed it at the police cars that were chasing him. He didn't really catch my eye at first, or he didn't see me at first. But he pointed the gun at the police officers, and they were in their cars, and I really didn't notice what they were doing at that point, but he lost interest in pointing the gun at them, and he noticed that I was parked across from where he had stopped. It turns out that the weapon that he was carrying was actually a CO2 cartridge pistol that was unloaded. Of course, you couldn't tell that from being 50 feet away. I just assumed it was some sort of small automatic weapon. He made a dash towards my car across the freeway. He got to the center line of the northbound lane where I was parked. He had jumped over the median. One of the photographs is sort of a classic. People like to flash around. He's got a small cigarette hanging from his mouth as he's jumping over the concrete barrier with the gun in his hand. And he begins coming my direction, and I thought to myself, it's now or never. So I basically put my head down and got my last couple of photographs and angled my car into the grass about what I thought would be about 100 feet or so north of where I was parked at. Would be far enough that he would have a difficult time taking a shot at me. There were several cars and SUVs and a couple motorhomes, in fact, that had stopped about 200 to 300 feet south of where I was parked at. They saw the commotion going on. My assumption was that he would probably, since he had already kind of probably checked me off as being a possible escape route, that he was probably going to try to get into one of those vehicles, because that was the direction he headed towards. There was a police video from a dashboard camera on one of the squad cars that showed him heading south towards these vehicles. It's hard to tell from the video, but it appears that he pointed the gun back towards the police during the chase, and that's when the police opened up. There were five, my recollection is five or six shots fired basically from two separate weapons. He was basically shot and wounded and fell in the northbound lanes of the freeway. I got out, at that point I was able to get out of my car. All of this happened within a matter of 1 or 2 seconds basically. Got out of the car, made several photographs of the police putting him in handcuffs on the middle of the freeway. From there, things got a little bit weird.
Talk me through that. I remember that you were confronted by police at some point, and maybe they even tried to seize your camera, your images?
Yeah, that's one of probably the most interesting aspect of this entire story is that there were two or three, maybe four, police officers at that point that saw me making photographs. They changed their direction from Sylvester towards me and began to chase me down. I was standing there making photographs of them, of course, approaching. And one of them started screaming that they wanted my camera. And I identified myself as being from the Pantograph. I was here to record the news story. But that didn't seem to stop them or bother them. Another one grabbed the camera and began pressing buttons, which had me pretty scared, because if they pressed the wrong series of buttons, it could have deleted the entire card at that point. They took the card and off they went with it, basically. And they told me, of course, to get out of there.
How'd you get the card back?
There was a sergeant in a McLean County Sheriff's vehicle that drove by and saw me screaming, and he stopped to listen to what I wanted. And I said, I need that card back. And, you know, he was like, well, I'll see what I can do, you know. And he went off to they had the incident command motor home present at the scene at that point. And he went in there and talked to Rusty Thomas, who at that point was an undersheriff in McLean County. And Rusty understood the legal issue involved with them confiscating my card. There was a state police forensics captain on the scene who would copy the card onto their image, onto one of their image drives. So they had all the images, but Rusty, thank God, came out and gave me the card back.
What was that moment like when you get back to the computer and you put the card in and you can see the images that you have?
Well, it was rewarding in the sense that I had enough sense of mind at that point to keep the shutter going and focus and exposure and all that right. I was disappointed that I didn't get the actual shooting when Sylvester was running towards the other vehicles. But the question, you know, I've been asked several times, and there's been some studies done on it about what should you do in that situation. Well, no photograph is worth your life. So and under the circumstances, I didn't know if it was a real gun or not. If I had known it was a real gun, if I had knew that it was a CO2 coverage gun and he didn't have any ammunition in it, I might have played the situation considerably differently.
This image of Robert Sylvester jumping over the median with the cigarillo in his mouth and the gun in his hand has become, I mean, it's almost a bit of a meme. It's been shared around the internet so much, this guy with the cigarette and the gun.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
So what does he look like to you? What do you see when you look at his face and you see his movement?
Well, it's interesting. Robert Sylvester was somebody who was fairly well known in Bloomington Normal. Was an iron worker. Union man had been on several construction sites. We didn't know all the circumstances around him at the time, but what we did find out about Robert Sylvester is that he was a very kind man. He took extremely good care of his family, probably to his own demise. I had one individual here in the community who told me that he was someone who liked to occasionally play cards, do a little bit of gambling, but would give his shirt off to any one of his family members. And several times he did that, which probably left him in a bit of a financial situation. At the time, if you recall, that was during the recession of 2008. Things were very bad for a lot of people in the unions, trades, in the Bloomington Normal at the time, because business essentially had stopped in this country.
Did you ever hear from his family or his closest friends?
Actually, his son called me the night after the shooting. He wanted to know what had happened, what I saw. It was very nice, very cordial. I told him what I knew about it. There had been a lot of debate in the past 24 hours if this was a suicide by cop sort of situation. And I think he sort of wanted to know what my opinion of that was. And I told him, I said, I didn't think it was. Robert was a gambler. He was someone who would take huge risks playing the card game. And I surmised that, you know, his use of the gun to bluff people was basically a bluff, and that he was playing a hand of cards right down to the bitter end, in my opinion.
Well, these images that you created, obviously the next day they're on the front of the Pantograph, the photo gallery at pantograph.com. Goes viral, millions of page views, I imagine.
It was 4 million, actually.
And then the images themselves, I assume, were distributed over the Associated Press wire, which means they travel around the world.
Yeah.
Can you talk about all the places that these images ended up being seen?
Everywhere. I mean, I was getting clips from people in Hungary and Ukraine, that they were in newspapers that far away, that people were actually using these things. They were papers in London and everywhere else. So it was, from a professional journalist perspective, it was nice to have somebody recognize your work, that they would publish it from that far away.
Had you ever felt like you were in danger, like you were on January 5th, 2009?
Before?
Yeah, before that day?
Yeah, there have been a couple of incidents over the years. I mean, when things were rough, there's probably been 9 or 10 situations could have been far more dangerous situations. There was the famous one was a oil refinery fire in Tulsa, Oklahoma, when I was there during the late 1980s. And the fire department and I got along really well. I mean, wherever they went, they took me with them, basically. And we had entered into the oil refinery pit where the fire was a huge, I don't know, 10, 20, 30,000 tank of petroleum product. And they were unable to stop the fire at that point, and the substance that was inside breached the walls of the tank and began spilling out in the pit where we were in. And the fire captain at the time said, everybody run for it. And we ran for it probably a couple hundred yards. And before we're probably more than 300 feet away, that the tank virtually lifted off of its foundation, went up into the air 300 feet, and came down with a massive fireball. And we were very, very lucky to have escaped with our lives.
This isn't even the most dangerous thing you've been involved
in. No,
with.
No. The Sylvester thing doesn't even rank in the top 10.
Wow. Other print publications, most recently the New York Daily News, have laid off their photographers,
right,
thinking that reporters can kind of do what you do with an iPhone and a little bit of training. Can you talk about what you feel that a trained photographer like you kind of adds to the experience of being a news consumer these days?
The issue is to be able to have an eye for composition. That's the element that most reporters don't bring to the equation. The other aspect of this is that most reporters who are given a camera and told to make pictures, well, they make pictures, and they might be at a scene, but they really, in most instances, don't know where the peak action is, peak emotion. The images that tell you really what's going on. And I think that the study and the character studies that we do as photojournalists are really a talent that has to be worked on over years, basically. I mean, I get plenty of interns from other colleges and part-timers and even full-time photographers who've just gone to school who really haven't figured it out yet. That's really what the story is about, to be able to capture a person's soul in the news photographs you're making. And when you can do that, you can really tell the reader a little bit more about the event by telling you who are the people behind the news story.
It's David Praber, the photo editor of the Pantograph, about his experiences 10 years ago shooting the now famous images of armed robber Robert Sylvester before he was fatally shot by police on Interstate 55. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see some of the photos from David Praber's gallery from that day at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, making an impact one grant at a time, supporting arts and culture, youth engagement, employment, career development, and more. More information about the impact you could have at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, an exercise in planning and implementation of a new Complete Streets program. That's coming up on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. Illinois high schools have voted to dramatically change the structure of the football season. Many schools have been conference hopping in recent years to seek a competitive advantage. Now the Illinois High School Association will eliminate conferences starting in 2021 for football only and will align schools in districts based on geography and enrollment to help schools play opponents of similar sized schools. Bloomington High School Athletic Director Tony Bauman tells GLT's Eric Stock the proposal has too many unanswered questions for him to support it.
I've heard other ADs and coaches expressing some of our same concerns, and some of it's just a fear of the unknown. I think these are things that the IHSA is going to have to look at, and hopefully we'll be getting some more direction as some of the more specific details come out. But some of our concerns are the first two games. Obviously, they want to leave those open so that you do have some flexibility in scheduling to bring in rivalry games and things like that, which is a good thing. But when they don't count towards the playoffs, it kind of brings up some concern on how do you approach those games. Yeah, you can approach them from the mindset that now it doesn't matter if you lose, so you can schedule tougher opponents, but you also have the risk of injuries and just, you know, you don't have to play those games. So our team's going to potentially take off week one and only schedule one. And it's just some of those uncertainties with those week one and two. The other issues, I think, are still, you know, the unknown of who's going to be in your district. Are they going to be relatively some parity between those? Or there's still the chance that somebody could have an easier district than somebody else to get through. There's also some concerns with travel. I think that won't be a concern for us, but obviously for some schools it could create some issues for them. So I think those were more of our major questions and concerns with it. And so we just weren't sure, and we would have liked to see those things before we could have positively voted yes in favor of it.
Was there any politicking on the part of athletic directors, coaches, or whomever because this was a membership vote?
No, I didn't feel that way. I felt like it was left up to each school, and I think we all recognized that it was going to be close. And if you were in a conference that had an even number of schools, we definitely understood how that was going to be a totally different perspective for you because your schedule, you didn't have that concern of trying to find those off games. And I will miss the conference, and that's something that I think has been around for so long that that's kind of sad to see. But I think it's just the evolution of sports. Some of those things happen. And, honestly, with some of the conference jumping that was taking place, conferences weren't being as consistent as what they used to be anyway. And our conference, obviously, in the Big 12, I think it's a great conference, isn't the initial same member schools that we started off with. So, you're going to see some changes. And I think, like I said, we'll try and make this a positive thing for us.
Do you think the conference hopping will be curtailed because of this, given the fact that football seemed to be driving so much of it, even to the Big 12 we saw in the last few years with the Decatur schools leaving and the Peoria schools coming on board?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It definitely won't be because of football anymore. But I think now, because football is not a factor in it, you might see some schools that are more willing to join certain conferences for the other sports, because I do think there are benefits of being in a conference. So now, where some schools might have been fearful of taking on, a conference that has a wide spectrum of enrollments, maybe now they're not as, fearful of joining that conference. So you might see some schools looking to find a conference now, that a different conference that maybe has a basketball schedule or a soccer schedule that's more attractive to them, because, there are still some scheduling concerns for athletic directors with all the other sports as well. But that'll be interesting to watch.
This was an entirely democratic process. As you said, the member schools voted for this, and even schools that don't sponsor football were allowed to vote on this. So 324 voted yes, 307 voted no, 69 abstained. That's still fewer than 50% of the membership supported such a sweeping change in the alignment of the football process. Do you have any qualms about that?
A little bit. But I think the process was, public. Everybody knew the process going into it. It's the process that they've used for all the proposals. I think that it is what it is in that sense. And, when you see, you like to be able to have a voice in the process. And so I think, there was a majority in a sense of there were more schools that voted for it that voted against it. So as close as it was, I think we have to accept that, we voted to push it through.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Tony Bauman, the athletic director at Bloomington High School. Have you tried to imagine who you might be paired up with in a district, and does that create concerns about travel?
For us, not so much. I think, when you're in those middle schools, the four, to six range, there's enough schools in our area that I don't think our travel will be significant. It'll be interesting to see, if we get the Springfield area, or do we get, some of the Peoria schools or the Champaign schools. I think we're still going to have a good chunk of schools that are from our Big 12 conference, so we'll still have some common opponents that we're used to playing. The big question for us is, will we get West in our district if we're the same enrollment? I think if we do, that helps keep some of our rivalries alive, because we'll be able to look to schedule normal community in week one or two and keep West. If we're not in the same district with West, that's going to create some concern for us, because with three schools, we wouldn't be able to create a rotation where we could all play each other in only 2 weeks. It would take 3 weeks to rotate through that. So we're hoping that West will be in our district so that we can keep that inner city games still going.
Well, and as you said, some schools may treat this as the exhibition season. So are you concerned that so much history, not so much with Normal West, they've not been around as long, of course, but you go back 100 years with Normal community and that could all go away?
Yeah, that is a concern. And like you said, I think right now it's looking like we'll be able to keep that game, but the approach to that game, I think, between the coaches and the players, there's still going to be enough of a grudge there that I think people will, put their hearts into it. But at the same time, coaches know that they really want to risk an injury. So do you play certain players as much as you might have played before? I think people will get a chance to take the field and there'll still be some bragging rights. But at the same time, week one, potentially that game could happen in week one. You can't risk, some of your star players going out in week one of the season.
Do you suspect that this is something that there's some resistance to at first, but then everyone will just get used to it and it'll just be part of the new routine?
I think people are curious to see it through. But I would not be surprised if there are some questions that don't go well, that some more proposals don't come forward. I think, we were ready to look at what could we do to make things a little bit better. But if this doesn't address those concerns, or it's not making the situation better, No, I don't think the memberships, you know, will sit back and say, well, this is what we – I think they'll keep looking to tweak it and add proposals and see if we can improve it along the way. But I do think it will be something that, you know, old conference football that we're used to, I think, you know, is going to be different now.
Now, when I talk to normal community, they have some of the same concerns that you have raised. They voted for it, given the fact that they said that scheduling has become so difficult for them for their open weeks. And I know that's been a challenge for you as well. And it quite often involves them having to travel to the St. Louis area or to the suburbs just to find somebody to play. So they are relieved that that's no longer going to be an issue for them. And I know that's been a concern for you as well to try to fill those open dates.
Yeah, very much so. I think I've been lucky these last couple of years that, you know, my off date was week two, but 2 years ago it was week four, and that was a struggle for us to find. And even when I found a two-year contract, after 1 year of that contract, the other team changed conference, and I was again searching for a week four in year two of what I thought I had committed. So definitely there were concerns if you had your open weeks in the middle of your season like that. It was just a challenge to find. And I think for a school like, you know, Normal, I think when you look at, you know, the enrollment difference within the Big 12, for them to be able to look at a schedule and say we're going to play schools that are similar to in our size, that's going to help them come to playoffs to have that experience against teams that they'll be competing with in the playoffs. So I definitely see it from their perspective, but they'll have to be willing to travel.
That was Bloomington High School Athletic Director Tony Bauman with GLT's Eric Stock. Under the new format, each district will have eight teams, and the top four will qualify for the playoffs.
How long has it been?
Every time I think of you.
Is there something you'd like to tell us?
I always catch my breath.
We're here for you. Is it time to tell us how much you appreciate GLT?
I ain't missing you.
It's been a while.
Since you've been gone.
Let us know you care too. Make a year-end contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Eye Credit Union, providing big city convenience with local friendly service. Member owned and highly involved in the community, Mid-Illini Eye puts people before profits. Mid-Illini Eye Credit Union, where different is better. Details at MidIlliniICU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a feature from a place in Illinois where the words Nu et Iulien, O Iulin Skarvel til Posca are still common currency in Swedish. Both Bloomington and Normal have adopted complete streets policies, a promise to design streets in a way that's equally friendly to cars, bikes, pedestrians, and mass transit. Now they actually have to act on those policies. That's where a new complete streets implementation study comes in. GLT's Ryan Denham talks to McLean County Regional Planning Commission Transportation Planner Jennifer Six about the draft, which she says aims to coalesce complete streets aspiration with a list of where to start.
Try and find a way to make sure that they're all kind of on the same page, and so that everyone who's working with this concept and looking at ways to implement it on any street in Bloomington Normal that they feel is appropriate has a sense of, first of all, where we are in terms of how the policies work and how implementation should work. And then as a result of this study, to have some sense of where the priorities probably should begin, where the first set of implementations might be needed. As it happens, the city of Bloomington is already tackled several on the list that was generated in this draft report. So we're going to go back to the report and see if there are some other things we can include as opposed to those three, and we will have a sort of early signal on how these things work out from the work that the city is doing right now.
The Complete Streets implementation study that we're talking about, it's new, it's in draft form, as you've said, just released this past week, at least to the public. So it links Complete Streets to public transit in mm-hmm. sort of a big way. So why are those two things so intertwined here?
Part of Complete Streets, really the essence of Complete Streets, is to look at any stretch of roadway, whether it's a neighborhood street or a big arterial or, you know, main street, that kind of thing, and ask, how can we make this as usable as possible and as safe as possible for everybody? Not just people in cars, not even just people in buses, but people on foot, people bicycling, anyone who might want to use the roadway for some reason should be able to do so and be safe there. That's a complete street. Now, not every complete street application, implementation, is necessarily going to be able to give equivalent weight to all of those users. Sometimes you have to prioritize. There may be areas in which, say, for example, on a big arterial street with not a lot of good crossing spaces, you might have to prioritize over, say, pedestrians for bicycles, for example. But for the most part, what we're trying to do is find ways in which to optimize access for absolutely everybody. By the way, that also includes people using assistive devices of any kind. So that if you're in a wheelchair and you need to cross the street, you should be able to do it every bit as safely as someone who's able to walk.
Disclosure first. I should make a matter of disclosure. GLT's program director, Mike McCurdy, is chair of the Connect Transit Board of Trustees. He played no role in the content or questions of this interview. Can you give an example of how bad pedestrian design can discourage mass transit use? So if a street is not designed using complete streets concepts and it is there are barriers for pedestrians to move across it, can you talk about how that impacts transit use?
We can, and it's particularly important right now as the transit system is attempting to do what they're calling installing better bus stops. So part of what makes a better bus stop, in their terms and in general terms, is the ability to get from wherever you start, your home, your office, whatever, to that bus stop. That means you have to have a sidewalk and some sort of access point to either a shelter or a waiting area or whatever that's close to where the bus is going to stop. And there are lots of locations where we have serious issues in terms of that kind of accessibility. So there's either not a sidewalk available, or there's a sidewalk, but there's no path along the right-of-way into the bus, so people are walking through grass or whatever. We have to worry about things like snow removal. We have an awful lot of people who are either not able to access the regular fixed route buses because they can't get through the snow if it hasn't been plowed or removed or whatever, and also people who use the mobility services, paratransit, because they can't functionally get to a regular bus stop through those kinds of barriers. They might otherwise be able to, but with those kinds of constraints, and certainly with the lack of sidewalks, that would be a barrier to anyone being able to use them. That's part of what the Better Bus Stops program is intended to address, is they do installation of shelters and pads for those and various other portions of the infrastructure. But part of it is also making sure that you can get to that location.
So this study spends a lot of time on where people work and mm-hmm. how they get to work. It says that 80% of people drive alone to work. Just 2% take public transit, which is less than the state average of 9%, less than the national average of 5%. Do you think that the way our streets are designed is a reason for that disparity? Why only 2% of our community members take the bus to work?
I actually think it has much more to do with the general affluence in McLean County and the fact that virtually everybody has access to at least one vehicle. This is a very car-centric community. That's been true for a long time. And we have been perhaps not as quick to recognize the need to expand our options as we should have been. We're working on that now, hence the complete streets policy and an attempt to look for ways to implement them and make them functional across the board. Commuting is a serious issue because that's why most people are on the road. They're either going to work or they're going to school and back and forth. And yes, people run errands and they do other things in their cars, but the sort of dominant use for the transportation system is getting to and from work or another important daily activity like school. As a university community, obviously, one of the benefits we have now is that so much of the ISU community uses Connect Transit. And it's been an enormous driver for the transit system, and it's shown us where we can go and how we can improve access to transit in a way that will make it more desirable a choice for people who really want to get to where they're going and do it in the best way possible. As to why our rate of transit use is lower than in some other places, again, there's the car issue, but also we're nowhere near as dense as a location like the Chicago area, where you've got a transit availability in ways that can't be contemplated for Bloomington normal. We just don't function that way. And where you have an awful lot of people concentrated around every transit location. So their ability to get to it and use it in numbers just dwarfs what we could achieve here just because of the density issues.
Well, I'll stress again that this study is in draft form and will be revised in the coming months. I do want to ask you this, though. The City of Bloomington's Engineering Division raised some concerns about the study's focus on transit as it was coming before the Transportation Commission this week. Those engineering division folks said that we question why the study strongly prioritizes and focuses on corridors along significant transit routes at the expense of other street corridors without a transit route that may see greater overall benefits with a complete streets implementation. So what's your reaction to those concerns?
I understand their point, and I think there are probably some locations where we need to do some alteration or some revision to a street network so that it is more accessible for people who are either on foot or on bicycles or using some other mode. Part of the reason for the transit emphasis is that transit vehicles move a lot of people. So the more people we have able to access them, the better we can move people around town. And, you know, it's greater numbers than we see with pedestrians as individuals or as a group or with other people using bicycle lanes, for example. A lot of these implementation scenarios involve adjustments to the street that not only accommodate transit, but will also accommodate pedestrians in a better way and bicycle users, because in many cases we're looking at a road diet. In other words, a narrowing of the traffic lanes for cars or a reduction in the number of lanes so that we can add widened sidewalks or more commonly bicycle lanes on the street.
When you talk about road diets, this study also brings up reconstruction and resurfacing. When streets come up for kind of their regular cycle of resurfacing or need to be rebuilt in some way, this study refers to that as an opportunity to do something, to do some kind of change related to complete streets. What do you mean by that?
If we're already looking at a situation where a given stretch of street needs to have some work done on it, whether it's a resurfacing, which is a relatively minor change, you know, you're just sort of painting over what's already there and making it the surface clean and usable, or a reconstruction where we actually are going down and across. So you might be rebuilding curb or adding curb or going into the pavement layers so that they can be essentially stabilized. And rather than just resurfacing and winding up with the same potholes year after year, you try and do it in a way that's more sort of construction intense so that the surface remains usable for a much longer period. Those are occasions on which, to some degree or other, depending on the level of the project, it's possible to make these changes without it creating a lot of extra cost. You're already, say, taking up, you know, a lane or two of a given street. As long as you're there, you can readjust the spacing of the lanes. You can add a bike lane. You can add an area where a bus can pull over and place a bus shelter or a place where people can stand and wait for the bus. And all of those things become part of the project. Sometimes, if we're really lucky, we come across funding opportunities where that's an element that is rewarded, so that we can look for grant funding and we can look for other opportunities of that kind to say, all right, we need to do this work. Let's look for ways that we can make it as inclusive as possible a project so that we can tap into some of these potential other areas of funding beyond the standards that are used for any kind of street work in town.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Jennifer Six, transportation planner for the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. All right, Jennifer, where have we seen complete streets concepts already implemented in Bloomington Normal? If people are trying to get a sense of what this means, so is there already an example floating around out there that we can kind of bring to mind?
I can, because it's right outside the Government Center building in downtown Bloomington. Bloomington has started work several months ago now on Front Street. So in between the parking deck behind Government Center and Government Center itself, and then down to a sort of across the entire couplet, the north-south couplet that encircles downtown. And part of that is to create a better accommodation for transit buses, many of which come through the transit, the transfer area in that location. But it's also providing improved access for pedestrians. There are going to be some provisions that let people cross the street more safely. They can stop in the middle if they need to, if there's traffic coming on. One of the interesting facets is that they have taken out the traffic signals and replaced them with stop signs in a couple of instances. And that's a long, complicated process in terms of how you sort of downgrade or downscale the level of traffic control. But it has to do with making sure that you're using the right scale of control and not unnecessarily delaying things just because it's a stoplight instead of a sign. There's much more to it. It's going to continue and be finished next spring. And that, I think, is going to be a kind of keystone project, a sort of show and tell for the community on how this works and the kinds of facilities you might see.
This Complete Streets implementation study ends by focusing on priority locations in town where the city, the town, state could start. So one of them is Main Street in Normal. It's the stretch between Rabb Road and Gregory Street. So that's the stretch just north of Illinois State University. People kind of know it as a speed trap, but, you know, near Fairview Park on the north end, there's the McDonald's, ISU Alumni Center, yada, yada. So where are the what are the opportunities for improvement on that specific stretch? This might help people understand kind of what you're aiming at.
It's interesting because that particular stretch, by the way, that's my neighborhood. So I know that speed trap very well because I see the lights flashing a lot. But there have been a lot of suggestions on how to treat that section of Main Street, that northern bound section in particular, partly because in more enthusiastic pavement laying periods, it's an awfully wide stretch of Main Street. There is a lot of room there. So there's a lot of room to do things that would be helpful to make the street more effective and allow people in cars to travel as, you know, fast as they want given the speed limit. And of course, the speed limit goes up as you get past Fairview Park and goes to 40 miles an hour up through Rabb Road. So there are a lot of possibilities there that we've talked about over the years. I think now we're looking again at this notion of how do we focus on safety so that pedestrians can cross that enormous, vast bit of pavement, and at the same time find locations that are appropriate for transit use. Find a way to make eventually that street usable, or that section of the street usable for bicycles. Right now, I'm not a terribly experienced bicycle rider, but even for people who are, I think that stretch of Main Street's a little bit daunting. It's very fast traffic, a lot of it. There's a speed trap, and there are transit vehicles using it. So there are a lot of potential obstacles and conflicts. That's a little bit further out, I suspect. The one real catch here is that Main Street is a state facility. And this is not something we can do willy-nilly. It's true of any adaptation on Main Street. So we're going to have to go through a process with IDOT and say, this is what we would like to see. And here are the reasons for it, and here's how we can justify these needs, particularly the safety-related ones, things like getting past pedestrians able to cross the street for access to transit stops. It's up to IDOT to then come back and say, yes or no, we're willing to do this or not.
So are you referring to the fact that there would be room side to side to do something like a median, like bike lanes? That's what you're sort of alluding to, is that it's, you got space, you could do something.
Part of what that stretch already has, for most of it, except the extreme southern point right at Gregory, is painted medians. So there's an area in the pavement that's essentially a occasional left turn lane, right turn lane, depending on where you are on the street. In some of those instances, there used to be actual concrete medians, which was nice because if you were trying to get across on foot at an intersection, say, and you know there's obviously no stopping the traffic on Main Street itself, you at least had a place to stand where you felt like you weren't quite so vulnerable to the traffic. That's something we really need to address, is how we handle pedestrian access across all of Main Street.
That's McLean County Regional Planning Commission Transportation Planner Jennifer Six with GLT's Ryan Denham. Six says they're still gathering feedback from Bloomington Normal officials about the study. Nothing in the study is required. Very little is already funded. Six says it would become a guiding document to prioritize future projects. This is Sound Ideas on Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Nestled among farm fields of western Illinois is the village of Bishop Hill. It's off the beaten path, though that hasn't stopped the small community from working to preserve Swedish heritage and maintain status as a tourist destination for day trippers. IPR's Emily Boyer reports.
¶¶ The band Hammer and Pick is entertaining visitors at Bishop Hill. They're performing in the Steeple Building, which is in the center of town. It's a large three-story cream-colored building complete with a clock tower on top. It was originally built to serve as a hotel and administrative building. Today, it's a museum. Tom DeDecker leads the Bishop Hill Heritage Association and has an office inside the Steeple Building. He says about 90% of the building is original, with the exception of the asphalt shingles on the roof and the electricity.
I come in here, and I'm walking the same floors that people did over 150 years ago. I go up to the second floor, and we have this exhibit with tools. You know, these are the tools they use to make these buildings. Or these are the tools that they use to make the furniture that is scattered around in this museum and other museums. It fills me with awe that I'm experiencing or I'm seeing or I'm touching stuff that was built by people so long ago and still with us today.
Bishop Hill is about 25 miles northeast of Galesburg. It was founded in 1846 by a group of Swedish immigrants who had followed their leader, Erik Jansson, to the wilderness of western Illinois in search of religious freedom and opportunity. At its height, the town's population grew to be nearly 1,000 people. The community was dissolved in 1861 following Jansson's death and a series of bad investments by community leaders. DeDecker says today there are 18 pre-Civil War colony buildings still in use at Bishop Hill and in their original location. Some of them are residential homes for the about 120 people who still live on site, but many of the other historic buildings have been renovated and repurposed into little shops and eateries featuring local favorites, including homemade Swedish rye bread and Swedish meatballs. Bishop Hill also has 7 museums, which is more museums per capita than any other town in Illinois. The community markets itself as a tourist attraction, bringing in between 80 and 100,000 visitors from around the world annually.
There's a lot of great festivals around here, and they're all special, unique in their own way. And our uniqueness is our history, because we not only value our Swedish roots, but our rural roots. So you're not just stepping back into Swedish traditions, you're also getting a taste of what it was like in the 1800s.
The popular Festival of Lights in December offers visitors a glimpse into what a Swedish Christmas looked like in the 19th century. On that night, there are candles in every window throughout the village and wreaths on many doors. In honor of Swedish tradition, many children around town dress up as Lucia girls and star boys.
Welcome to Happy St. Lucia.
St. Lucia, I invite you to have a cookie.
3 children welcome guests at the Creative Commons, which is the newest business in Bishop Hill. The Commons is an artist cooperative, classroom space, and concert hall. Many of the artisans selling their crafts at Bishop Hill still practice the same skills the pioneers did, such as broom making, pottery, wood carving, and rug making. In a neighboring boutique, Greta, who is 8, is also dressed up as a Lucia girl.
A white dress with a red ribbon tied around it and a candle crown.
Do you know what the Lucia girl history is at all? About what she used to do?
She would come around with a candle crown and she would give out cookies and breads to people.
According to Swedish mythology, St. Lucia gave food to the hungry during a time of famine. Her celebration eventually became known as the Festival of Lights. But it's not just the Swedish festivals that bring visitors to town. The Bishop Hill Museum, which is located on the south side of town, houses the largest collection of works by Olof Krans, who is a famous Swedish-American folk artist. Brian Engelbrecht is the assistant site superintendent at Bishop Hill. He says Olof Krans immigrated to America when he was 12 and grew up in Bishop Hill. He later became a house painter in Galva. He painted many scenes about the community from memory and completed portraits of many of the colonists from photographs. Engelbeck says Kranz's work provides a glimpse of what life was like at Bishop Hill.
This is actually considered the best visually documented of the different utopian communities that existed in American history. And so thanks to Olof Krans' work, we know pretty much exactly what the town looked like back in this time period. We know what many of the residents look like, and we have a great insight into the general day-to-day life of the colony.
One of Krans' largest works is titled Bishop Hill in 1855. It's an oil painting that depicts a theater curtain that is being pulled back to unveil an aerial view of town. Many of the prominent buildings included in the portrait still stand in Bishop Hill today. Bishop Hill is a National Historic Landmark and a State Historic Site. Todd Decker with the Bishop Hill Heritage Association says the community is still renowned in the home country of Sweden, and students learn about it in school.
People from Sweden, when they vacation in the Midwest, they tell us this is one of the must-see spots. They have to see Andersonville, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Bishop Hill.
Decker says that nearly a quarter of Sweden's population immigrated in the 19th century, and many of them came to the United States.
One of the reasons was the success of Bishop Hill. They heard about this large group of Swedes coming over here, you know, experiencing some success, and they thought, well, you know, if they could do it, we can do it.
Decker says many local organizations have been raising money to invest more in restoration efforts over the last few years. He says they're working to ensure that Bishop Hill's legacy continues on well into the future. I'm Emily Boyer.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.